fellow members and guests of the Philadelphia Society. The first of many references to Edmund Burke in Robert Nisbet's Prejudice as a Philosophical Dictionary occurs in Nisbet's very first entry, Abortion, where he offers a brief history both of abortion practices and a philosophical and theological perspectives from the Hebrews and ancient Greeks to the contemporary preoccupation with abortion. Eventually, Nisbet arrives at Roe v. Wade and its aftermath. After surveying the ongoing battles between militant abortionists and aggressive anti-abortionists, Nisbet concludes, "Rarely has sheer zeal overtaken a moral question in the measure that is found on both sides of the abortion question. What is badly needed at this juncture is a liberal infusion of expediency in Edmund Burke's noble sense of that word." While abortion was not an issue that dominated debate in Burke's House of Commons, his public career was marked by controversies as divisive then as abortion is now. Nisbet's invocation of Burke suggests that what we might learn from him has more to do with his general understanding of the aims and limits of political power than it does with specific policy proposals or outcomes. Nisbet's adjective, noble, further suggests that Burke's expediency is more than simply politics as usual and points toward prudence as the primary political virtue. The heart of Burkean expediency, which Nisbet contrasts with coercive law, is its respectful recognition of the powerful and necessary role of human existence of privacy, use and want, tradition and practicality, not to forget larger and long-range consequences. Burke argued that very plausible schemes with very pleasing commencements have often shameful and lamentable conclusions. He added, "Is then no improvement to be brought into society? Undoubtedly, but not by compulsion, but by encouragement, by countenance, favor, privileges, which are powerful and lawful instruments. The coercive authority of the state is limited to what is necessary for its citizens." This view of Burke is contestable, of course, and there are some commentators on Burke who may seek substantive policy guidance from him. The aim of my presentation is to illustrate the range of different interpretations of Burke that are found among American conservatives following World War II, when the contemporary conservative movement was starting to take form. This presentation will not be comprehensive. I was hard at work on this paper in January when I got an email from the Society's distinguished executive director telling me that I would have 20 minutes. And so with trepidation, I took my huge manuscript and approached her and said, "More, please." And you will be happy to know that I was no more successful than poor Oliver Twist was. So in the next 20 minutes, I hope to at least highlight the essence of six approaches to Burke. One. Russell Kirk wrote so extensively on Burke that there is no way to adequately summarize him here. So I will limit my remarks to the conservative mind. First, two preliminary comments. Whether or not Kirk provides the most accurate or authoritative account of Burke, I think he clearly is the heir of Burke's rhetorical throne among post-war conservatives. Second, I think that a more accurate title for the conservative mind would have been the Burkean mind. For as Kirk himself readily admits, the volume was confined to British and American thinkers who have stood by tradition and old establishments and is an analysis of thinkers in the line of Burke. Kirk, convinced that Burke's is the true school of conservative principle, excluded from consideration many who might identify themselves as conservative. The question of whether the influence of the conservative mind has unduly narrowed or misdirected efforts to understand the origins and nature of American conservatism is certainly worth exploring, but is beyond the scope of my remarks, except as raised by other authors I discuss. For Kirk, there is no division between a young liberal Burke and an older conservative Burke, for there is a steady, continuous development in Burke's ideas from the earliest to the latest of the crises he was involved in. What did Burke seek to conserve? He stood resolutely for preservation of the British Constitution with its traditional division of powers as a system most friendly to liberty and order to be discerned in all Europe. But Burke was not simply a parochial defending merely national institutions for merely nationalistic reasons. A moral order, good old prescription, cautious reform, writes Kirk, these are elements not merely English but of general application. The intellectual system of Burke then is not simply guarding British political institutions. Beyond the British Constitution, Burke stood for preservation of the larger constitution of civilization. Kirk enumerates the chief articles of this universal constitution: reverence for the divine origin of social disposition, reliance upon tradition and prejudice for public and private guidance, conviction that men are equal in the sight of God, but equal only so, devotion to personal freedom and private property, opposition to doctrinaire alteration. On a panel entitled "The Liberal Origins of Conservative Thought," it is incumbent to emphasize an aspect of Burke that Kirk recognizes. No one better apprehended the arguments for reform, but reform, said Burke, needs a delicate touch. Kirk's account of Burkean reform led him to conclude that Burke was always a liberal, but never a Democrat. It is important to note that Kirk writes of both small L liberals, who may simultaneously be reformers and conservators, and capital L liberals, committed to an decidedly un-Burkean political ideology of radical innovation. Kirk provides a taste of Burkean liberalism when he turns to the liberal conservatives Macaulay, James Fenimore Cooper, and Tocqueville. Kirk writes, "We are in danger of forgetting how strongly attached the old liberals were to liberty. Political liberalism was conservatism of a sort. It intended to conserve liberty." I take the lessons these three learn from Burke to be the heart of Burke's liberalism: a tenderness for private property and a suspicion of any political power not grounded upon a propertied interest. He reminded them that a people is not simply an aggregation of persons told by its head. Burke's misgivings as to government was nearly so marked as his veneration of the state, and the liberals inherited his ideal of a government which governs so little as it prudently can, which rarely invokes its reserved powers. The foregoing raises two questions. First, what's the relationship between small L and capital L liberalism? Is the latter, to use a term from Eric Voegelin, a deformation of the former, the hardening of a living reality into an ideology? Second, is there a similar distinction between small c and capital C conservatives that needs to be made? Is it possible to go no further than our current text that Kirk's canons of conservative thought have, for some, ossified into the canons of conservatism, heavy artillery designed to blow one's opponents away in an ideological war? Kirk situates the foundation of Burke's thought in Christianity. Revelation, reason, and an assurance beyond the senses tell us that the author of our being exists and that he is omniscient. The man and the state are creations of God's beneficence. This Christian orthodoxy is the kernel of Burke's philosophy. Here are, in bullet point fashion, a few of the implications that Kirk draws from his discussion of Burke's orthodox foundation. Every state is a creation of providence, whether or not its religion is Christianity. Burke states that a universal equality among men exists, but it is the equality of Christianity, moral equality, or more precisely, equality in the ultimate judgment of God. Burke believed that the church must be interwoven within the fabric of the nation. Burke praises two great virtues, the key to private contentment and public peace. They are prudence and humility, the first preeminently an attainment of classical philosophy, the second preeminently a triumph of Christian discipline. Tradition and prescription are the guiding lights of the civil social man, and therefore Burke elevates to the dignity of social principles those conventions and customs which, before the 18th century, most men accepted with an unreflecting confidence. Kirk sums up Burke's natural law teaching as follows, and I should mention a longtime distinguished member of the society, Peter Stanlis, who agreed with Kirk on Burke's natural law foundations. The true natural rights of men, then, are equal justice, security of labor and property, the amenities of civilized institutions, and the benefits of orderly society. For these purposes, God ordained the state, and history demonstrates that there are the rights desired by the true natural man. Two, while Kirk was perhaps the most influential conservative promoter of Burke in the post-war years, he was not the first. Francis Graham Wilson featured discussions of Burke in a number of articles published during the war and in The Case for Conservatism, published in 1951. According to Wilson, Burke was trying to say that while we must live with history, while we cannot escape its impact upon us, we can also live there with enthusiasm and with loyalty to the historical community of which we are a part. Wilson maintained that Burke's system was a defense of the national tradition and of the nation state as the context for the good life. That is to say, Wilson understands Burke's universal argument for tradition and the nation state to have particularistic and diverse implications for how different peoples should live their lives. The lesson Burke taught, writes Wilson, is that while there was a pattern in history, each nation had to learn its own lesson from its own national tradition. Wilson explicitly contrasts Burkean and American conservatism. While Burke appealed both to the established principles of the British Constitution and to the principles of sound government, our leaders could appeal only to the principles of society on which they believed a just system might exist. In Wilson's opinion, the Federalist Papers rank with the writings of Burke in the creation of the modern conservative spirit in politics. Wilson's sense of American conservatism is best captured in this passage. Conservative spirit in America is never simply a defense of things as they are, for at the height it seems to blend the fading past and the emerging future into an imaginative presence. While it can never do is relieve men of their responsibility in the vast context of experience. Three. While Francis Graham Wilson sees Burke and the Federalist Papers as co-equal foundations of American conservatism, one of his students, Wilmore Kendall, was not as forbearing as was Wilson. Kendall pushes Wilson's insight into the Federalist Papers further than Wilson did. In the posthumously published The Benevolent Sage of Macosta, Kendall takes direct aim at Kirk's claim that Burke is the father of American conservatism, writes Kendall. And Kendall always writes in the mouthfuls. So, hold on. If we were to assume that conservatism equals adherence to the old and tried, equals opposition to change, then we must look askance at the contention that both Burke and the founders of the American Republic were conservatives. For even if we grant that the American Revolution was on one side a conservative reaction against innovation by that wicked fellow George III, the feat of fitting the founding fathers into the category of opponents of change and adherents of the old and tried is one that, quite simply, no one, not even someone with Russell Kirk's gifted pen, is going to bring off because it cannot be done. Change, and not slow change either, was the watchword on these shores from the moment of the Mayflower Compact, which in and of itself was a breathtaking political innovation. As in due course, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States were also to be innovations. I know that all that was done in accordance with the traditional rights of Englishmen. But after you have milked all that dry, you are still up against the fact that principled general opposition to change, political, social, economic, what have you, was not characteristic of our founding fathers, was never in American conditions, and is not today a possible political posture, save perhaps as we confine our purview to the ancient moral traditions of mankind, and only if you can work all men are created equal into your picture of those ancient moral traditions. Put otherwise. Take Burke as your Bible for this purpose. Take as your premise that what Burke taught is conservatism, and you will indeed find yourself with passages on your hand that point you to adherence to the old and tried as the essence of conservatism. But take the Federalist as your Bible, and you will find few such passages and very guarded ones when you do find them. Take a breath. Four. Leo Strauss's account of Edmund Burke is of a valiant effort gone awry. Burke attempted a last-minute return to the pre-modern conception of natural right. At one level, perhaps, Burke was successful in this venture, for his conservatism is in full agreement with classical thought. At a deeper level, however, Burke's career is marked by a tragic paradox. It's my term, not Strauss's. For while Burke's conservatism was in agreement with classical thought, Burke's interpretation of his conservatism prepared an approach to human affairs which, in Strauss's view, is even more foreign to classical thought than the very radicalism of the theorists of the French Revolution. In opposing the radical French intrusion of the spirit of speculation or of theory into the field of practice of politics, Burke seems to return to Aristotle's practical political science. However, Burke is not content with defending practical wisdom against the encroachments of theoretical science. He parts company with the Aristotelian tradition by disparaging theory and especially metaphysics. After a comparison of classical and Burkean views of constitution making, Strauss offers this summary conclusion. Classical political philosophy was the quest for civil society as it ought to be, the best regime without qualifications. But Burke's political theory is, or tends to become, identical with a theory of the British Constitution. By favoring historical jurisprudence over metaphysical jurisprudence, however, Burke paves the way for the historical school. And this is the tipping point for Strauss that converts conservative Burke into the most radical opponent of classical philosophy. Rather than judging the wisdom of the British Constitution solely by virtue of its adherence to transcendent standards, Burke affirms, "Our Constitution is a prescriptive constitution. It is a constitution whose sole authority is that it has existed time out of mind." Burke wanted to establish political principles on historical foundations, but the search for standards grounded in the particulars of history ignores the possibility that particular or historical standards can become authoritative only on the basis of a universal principle which imposes an obligation to accept them. For Strauss, therefore, the historical school inevitably slides into historicism, which for Strauss is a particularly virulent form of relativism. 5. Richard Weaver's primary treatment of Burke is found in The Ethics of Rhetoric and offers an analysis of Burke's representative style of argument. "The true conservative," writes Weaver, "is one who sees the universe as a paradigm of essences of which the phenomenology of the world is in continuing approximation." William Buckley, Jr. declared that was the best one-sentence definition of a conservative he knew of. Following this line of argument, Weaver maintains that those who prefer the argument from definition are conservatives in the legitimate sense of the word. While Weaver recognizes that Burke is widely respected as a conservative who was intelligent enough to provide solid philosophical foundations for his conservatism, he concludes that Burke had a strong addiction to the argument from circumstance, and he further maintains that this is the argument fatal to conservatism. This is crucial for Weaver, for he believes that a man's method of argument is a truer index of his beliefs than his explicit profession of principles. Weaver documents Burke's addiction to the argument from circumstance in three representative controversies from Burke's career: the Catholic question, the American Revolution, and the French Revolution. Weaver's final judgment is that Burke's primary reliance on the argument from circumstance undermines his explicit invocation of natural law, leads to short-sightedness, a mindless opposition to incumbency, and the unintentional courting of failure. While Burke left many wonderful materials which political conservatives should assimilate, these were always auxiliary rhetorical appeals. Weaver concludes that Burke was magnificent at embellishment, but of clear rational principle, he had a moral distrust, and therefore Burke should not be taken as a prophet by conservatives. 6. Edmund Burke enters the Constitution of Liberty as a member of the English team in Friedrich Hayek's comparison of the English and French traditions of liberty. The English approach to liberty is captured in Adam Ferguson's observation that nations stumble upon establishments which are indeed the result of human action, but are not the execution of human design. For Hayek, the greatest difference between the two views, English and French, is their respective ideas about the role of traditions and the value of all the other products of unconscious growth proceeding throughout the ages. Rationalists who believe that all useful institutions are deliberate contrivances and who cannot conceive of anything serving a human purpose that has not been consciously designed are almost of necessity enemies of freedom. What the English team sees as freedom appears to the French team as merely chaos. For those open to accidental and evolutionary developments, however, the value of freedom consists mainly in the opportunity it provides for the growth of the undesigned, and the beneficial functioning of a free society rests largely on the existence of such freely grown institutions. After noting the importance of a genuine reverence for grown institutions, for customs and habits, Hayek concludes, paradoxical as it may appear, it is probably true that a successful free society will always, in large measure, be a tradition-bound society. Burke also plays a role in Hayek's postscript of the Constitution of Liberty, Why I Am Not a Conservative. Hayek begins by noting the contemporary confusion in the meaning of liberal, liberalism, and conservative, made worse by the recent attempts to transplant to America the European style of conservatism, which, being alien to the American tradition, has acquired a somewhat odd character. His decisive objection to conservatism is that by its very nature, it cannot offer an alternative to the direction in which we are moving. Conservatives may serve as a brake on the vehicle of progress, but cannot move society toward a new objective. The true conservatives of Europe, Hayek argues, did show an understanding of the meaning of spontaneously grown institutions, such as language, law, morals, and conventions. But the admiration of the conservatives for free growth generally applies only to the past. Hayek, however, does not include Burke among the true conservatives. Rather, he accepts Lord Acton's account of Burke, Macaulay, and Gladstone as the three greatest liberals. In part, Hayek's lecture is a search for the appropriate name for the Party of Liberty. Nearing the end of this lecture, Hayek almost sighs. What I should want is a word which describes the party of life, the party that favors free growth and spontaneous evolution. Earlier, he had written, Edmund Burke remained an old Whig to the end and would have shuddered at the thought of being regarded as a Tory. As Hayek concludes his search, he states, the more I learn about the evolution of ideas, the more I become aware that I am simply an unrepentant old Whig, with a stress on the old. So the structure of my remarks thus far reminds me of one of my favorite childhood TV shows, To Tell the Truth, in which three contenders claimed to be the same person, and the panel of judges was supposed to, by asking questions, choose who was who. So let me very quickly summarize our six contenders. Russell Kirk's Burke is primarily a defender of good old prescription and the intellectual founder of conservatism on both sides of the Atlantic. Francis Graham Wilson recognized both Burke and the Federalist as foundational for the modern conservative spirit and emphasizes Burke's pluralism in recognizing a variety of national traditions. Wilmore Kendall rejects Burke, defender of Crown and Church, as foundational for an authentic American conservatism. For both Leo Strauss and Richard Weaver, Burke's mode of argument undercuts the explicit principles he articulates. And finally, Friedrich Hayek embraces Burke as a fellow old Whig, a member of the Party of Life, the party that favors free growth and spontaneous evolution. If this were an episode of To Tell the Truth, it would conclude with the host saying, will the real Edmund Burke stand up? And I am out of time. Thank you very much.